What's up, everybody? This is Carrick with ACG, and I'm here with another why video where you ask cool questions and I try to give you somewhat good answers. So many of these are actually questions from the last video that I didn't get a chance to answer, as well as some from recently that have popped up, especially around popular media, different things that have come up. So I asked somebody to put these together from the best questions that they could find. These are from people who are on Patreon. These are from people who are on Discord. People who are on Twitter, Facebook. I think we opened it up to a bunch of different folks. Hopefully this one will be a little bit shorter than the last one. I apologize. Sometimes I can go for a long period of time. It depends on the kind of question and the kind of answer and information I can give you. But it certainly should be at least somewhat fun. Let me get a drink. All right, here we go. Oh, and I want to say thanks to all the support. Ton of support recently. Ton of new people on the Patreon. Ton of new people in there enjoying games together. Today and yesterday have been an absolute blast going in there playing, just doing all sorts of crazy shit. So thank you very much for all of those people and anybody watching and listening abroad. Gibbons45 says, how do you figure out what you're worth? What if they want too much? How do you figure out what you are worth? What if they want too much? Okay. That's a channel person talking about. So how do you figure out what you're worth? All right. So if you're looking at yourself, so this is something that I'm not going to be able to answer as in depth as a lot because I don't actually do it myself, but we did have a couple PR people on from the last couple podcasts ago. I'll have to get the number and try to throw it in the description. If I don't, I apologize. Who came on and sort of explained this. First of all, there are websites you can go to where you can enter your social data and find out sort of what you're worth, you know, what something you do is worth, what a video is worth, that kind of thing. But it really is just looking, I'm assuming, at the same algorithms, YouTube, watch times, all that kind of stuff. But it's not really covering like advertisements or, you know, if you're demonetized, it's probably looking at, like I said, watch time, user retention, thumbs up, that kind of thing. When it comes to deciding what you're worth, it's really going to be ultimately up to you. And I personally believe it just doesn't work for me. I don't like this kind of thing for my channel. But if it was for somebody starting out, I would say what you're worth is probably not a lot. You know, it's checking out the game and covering it. And this is something I believe since day one. Once you put some work in, right? Once you get some people who are checking out your shit, and once you get some knowledge out there and a couple of videos out there, then, you know, that might change. And somebody's like, hey, here's a code. And that code is what you're worth, really, when you think about it, right? That code is what you're worth. It's 5, 10, 15, up to 60 bucks. And you cover it. And that is what the company feels you're worth. Now, I think this question might have come up because in the last like 2 months, we've had a lot of things about like Twitch streamers and how much they make. And you know, it's certainly come up on YouTube with demonetization and all those kind of crazy things. So I can't really answer exactly for you, but I would say there might also be some people that you can ask. And I would certainly say check out like a Reddit YouTube forum, because I know that they have a large forum where YouTubers can ask questions, or Twitch can ask questions. And there's a lot of nice people there who can help you out when you have a question of like, hey, you know, I'm this size of a channel and I want to know, should I offer to cover something for a certain amount of money? I will say this. I think that I'm not saying it's going away. I think Twitch, in fact, is probably even larger than it was. But I think for a lot of companies, they know that they can get a grassroots campaign from a smaller channel without paying a bunch of money to a bigger, you know, a bigger YouTuber and still get coverage. It depends also on product release. Like, is it like released to everybody, or is it going to be an early, let's say, hardware test of a brand new webcam or something like that? It would depend on the size of your channel and stuff. So it's a difficult question to answer, really. And it's one that has to do a lot with what you've already offered prior and what they can look at. And at least I'm assuming that's what it is. We did have, like I said, a couple PR people on a couple podcasts ago. And I remember one of them saying that people were asking more and more, and that they believed that a lot of times it was worth it. But I would say if more people are asking for more, then there's also a contingent out there that if you don't ask for anything, it can work out for you. And it's worked out for me really well. It's just like, hey, I want to check out your game. And it that's how I do my thing. It doesn't mean how you would want to do yours. But I think with YouTube, I started out there was no plan to make money. And I think most people who start out on YouTube, your idea really should not be, hey, I want to be a multimillionaire. It shouldn't, because those kind of people probably wouldn't even be asking me this question. they would be trying to do goofy top 10 lists or, you know, some kind of witty, you know, super duper humoristic kind of videos where it's just really funny all the time, or some type of crazy thing. And that's how you explode. I think somebody like myself will never explode unless I get that one viral video or something like that. So really does also depend on what you cover next time. Or if you need more data on this, if you say what you do, what segment of gaming, I can certainly answer it a little bit better. So I apologize for that. Next up is Snords Irregular. Hello, sir. I saw 4 reviews who liked WWZ a lot. I always read that as WW2. World War Z a lot and a couple that didn't. Got it anyway, and I'm having an absolute blast. Fun factor really does seem to matter. But let's say on a bigger game, does getting a polarizing score... Oh, do you find that getting a polarizing score is unusual on a bigger game? I don't really find it that unusual because you can look at Zelda and there's somebody who's going to dislike it, right? As long as there's context within why they like something or dislike it, for me, fun factor works because I think it is not something that a lot of people take into account. And for me, fun factor might be different than yours. So of course that would make sense to you. You might be coming to me to listen about sound and music and voice, but maybe fun factor, you have to identify in a different way, that kind of stuff. I really don't get that surprised. I don't get that surprised because how is it that we think that we can celebrate an industry so vast as one that has multiple genres and mixed genres from Metroid and Castlevania to Metroidvania, right? You're getting all these crazy things. Your protagonists can be robots, men, women, aliens, all kinds of stuff, creatures. It just doesn't matter. You can have all these different things in all these different genres. And to find that everybody will feel the exact same way about something is a completely alien. What really should matter is the context. Do they apply the context and do they explain it? And if they do, that's life. That really is life. It's just somebody's idea of something. There's always going to be somebody out there who thinks that they know it all, right? Like you should only believe them. That kind of bullshit always happens. But overall, when you look at these kind of things, you look at something like a Zelda. If somebody gives it a score of 6 or 7 out of 10 and everybody else is announcing it as a 10, then you got to look at it and find out why, if you're interested. And you may find out something like bugs, right? Something like bugs, that's a really neglected factor when it comes to reviews and when it comes to coverage, that bugs are a big deal and they're also very chaotic. Just because you got it doesn't mean somebody else didn't, but at the same time, you did. And that matters. That legit matters that you got a bug. It's almost like saying, oh, well, 1,000 people bought 1,000 of the same kind of car. One guy's brakes didn't work and he died. Let's just magically pretend that the other 999 are fine and we won't look into it. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. So instead, for me, I would say the context is really important. When they're explaining if it's bugs or it just didn't work for them. Also, you'll sometimes see somebody who's like, hey, I normally review RPGs, but I'm reviewing a sports game. And you have to be all, exactly what are they going to take out of this? Unless, of course, that, sports game suddenly has RPG elements or something. But yeah, it can definitely happen. I don't find it that crazy as long as context is provided. And I think that might be one of the missing factors is context and the ability to talk to people and explain to people what you found within that context, because you may try to explain it, may not hit people. And we've all had this. I mean, you're going to get, there's always, you know, somebody pretend that they don't, but you will always have those mistakes. It doesn't matter how big the reviewer is. It doesn't matter how small they are. It doesn't matter if they're a previewer, if they just do impressions, if they just cover brand new tech or old games, there'll be that time where they thought they were explaining something well and they didn't. And that also occurs because you're human and you're fallible and that's just the way it is as well. So sometimes you'll see a 6 and you'll just be like, I don't see how this is supported. Well, guess what? Maybe it's not. Maybe they thought it was. And to them, this is something that we've talked about in the podcasts where a developer might be working on a game and it's their baby, right? And they like it and maybe they don't see the problems with it. And you get those kind of things, and you get those kind of things with everything. If somebody really likes RPGs, they may be able to look over a crunchiness that somebody who expects a higher presentation can't. And as long as they offer context, I think that's fine. We recently had, I can't remember who it was. There was a big game and they had a bug, a game killing bug, and they rated it what I would have probably rated a game-killing bug. I can't remember what it was, but they had this game-killing bug. They rated it, and they went back and they changed their score. There's multiple ways you could do that. You could certainly see somebody doing that. That bug is game-killing, where maybe I didn't get it. So you have to decide how you're going to go about and score it. Are you going to score it and say, hey, up until this point, it was a 9, and then once I got this game-killing bug, it was a 1 because I can't continue and I want to. You have those kind of issues. That's why bugs are really important, I think. So is fun factor. Those kind of things are a little bit harder to make really tangible, and that's where your context needs to lie. It's actually one of the reasons why a lot of people will say, can you do, I would like to do them anyway, but I haven't been able to decide to how to do it. But I hear people say, oh, I'd like timestamps for sound, music, and voice. And yes, that absolutely makes sense on the top end. One, the way I put these videos together, it's a little bit more difficult than just doing that. But the second is also, a lot of times if you're trying to apply context to gameplay, you can apply it if sound matters in the gameplay, positional sound, right? You're mentioning that in the sound section. So if somebody jumps over sound and you have mentioned it in the sound section, then you either have to repeat it or you have to find some other way to give that same data over again. And so it is, I think all this comes down to context. And when it comes to big games like this, it's not that surprising to me to see polarized reviews of some kind. At least one, right? At least one. I don't think there's a game out there that we haven't seen where somebody's given it a 10, somebody else given it a 4, and it's been a bad game or a good game. Next one up is Parks and Reckoned. Parks and Reckoned. Do you think that review embargo timing has a direct connection to a game's quality? So this one, you might be in the Discord because we actually had this discussion. Has it ever? Yes, for sure. Will it in the future? Absolutely. In some instance, it will. But you also, and this is something that I always like to talk about, is, and this is why I like to have developers on the international podcast to talk about this. Development is a weird subject, especially when you start looking at certification times, how you patch your game, all these crazy things. And so what can possibly happen, especially when you look at this, you can have a game that is being worked on right up until release, right? That's one thing, a technical thing, right up until release. And that's just the way the cookie crumbles. You also have story. Story is a big thing. The Avengers, you know, from what I understand yesterday, some stuff got leaked and about the ending. And so that you have a lot of companies who are like, hey, this is a story-based game. We don't want this leaking. They'll either make you sign insane NDAs, which you guys have seen from me, because a lot of companies do that. A lot of companies will say, we want you to cover the game, but you can't show this or that or that or this, right? You can't even, I mean, some will be really tight. They'll be like, you can't show after the first, you know, 2 or 3 levels. It's just pretty crazy. It all depends on the embargo. So you can definitely have that. I would say when you look at gaming, especially when you look at all of this and all of the games that are released, thousands of games, it absolutely does occasionally happen, but I think more often than not, it really is many other factors, including that development. And the reason why I say that, and the only context I can give for the reason why it fits for what I'm seeing, is that I have seen a number of games with early code that is not good. They are not good games, or they are not very good. When I say not good, I don't mean that they're like never touch, because that has to be a very bad game for me, because that's what it means, never touch. But like wait for a deep, deep sale. When you're talking about a $60 game and you're dropping down to $5 or $10, there's got to be some pretty serious issues with that versus, let's say, a $30 game. So it can certainly happen. I can definitely see that being an issue. But I think overall, no, there's so many different things that can go on. There's so many different ways in which games are released digitally. There's also the weirdness that we get where you'll have embargoes be different across the world because the time zones aren't figured into it. So instead of a 12 o'clock release schedule for everybody, so it might be 12 in the Pacific, but a different time in East Coast, 3 hours ahead in the East Coast, but their embargo is also 3 hours ahead. So you actually get a proper embargo, but you also get the ones where it's like 12 everywhere. So it's 12 Pacific for the people in the Pacific, and then 12 Eastern for the people there, and then 12 for people in Australia. You get a 12-hour gap, right? It might even be 14 at that point. I can't remember what that gap is. It's pretty massive because I've had some people from Australia on the podcast, and there's a pretty massive time gap. I don't remember exactly. So you definitely can have situations like that. Embargoes and timing is a difficult thing to discuss, especially when you look, like I said, at these games with their huge stories, and a lot of companies really being nervous about it and wanting to make sure that the story isn't spoiled. And I don't think that's too hard of a discussion to have when we do see consistent, no matter where you are, discussions in communities about spoilers. You can't be sitting in a lot of these communities and be talking about horrible spoilers at times, in thumbnails or all types of crazy places, and then not assume it also can connect to some games. And then other games, yeah, they wait because it's not very good. I would say usually what'll happen then is you won't get review code, right? That usually would be more of a sign than anything. I think even Bethesda originally went away from that. It's like I had to street buy a couple games from them when they were doing their day and date kind of thing. And then they changed. So, but I think when that kind of situation occurs, then you do sort of look at it and you're like, what exactly, you know, no review code. What does that mean exactly? So yeah, difficult situation to discuss. That's for sure. And interesting. And it'll continue to change as digital games become so prevalent, and you have these games that can be patched day one. So it's like when you review, luckily the games, like if I get told that there's a day one review or a day one code and patch, I'll just be like, are we playing that one? Because if we're not, then I'm not doing that review like that, because that wouldn't make any sense. And most of the time you are. Most of the time, you know, in a way the reviewers are testing it. They'll be like, yeah, you'll get a day one patch. Then there's also for other people a day one patch. So yeah, interesting times. Johnny says, let's see, question. What do you think of the general ads-based monetization model for most content creation? Do you see a general move towards viewers supporting creators directly? It's a good question. I don't know. This is twice now where I really haven't had a great answer on these. I apologize. But so ads-based monetization, especially as somebody who gets demonetized all the time, is very difficult. And I have a patron, but I didn't make my Patreon account. I didn't create my Patreon account until much later, once I had videos created and once I was really sort of solidified in how I wanted to run the channel and what I felt I could offer people. Because to me, Patreon was more of a, here's what I have, do you want to join in? Not here's what I want to make, do you want to help me create it? What's nice about Patreon is it can adjust, and I would say it's more the second now, but when it starts, that's sort of the way it was. Now you see a lot of people creating Patreon accounts day and date for a YouTube channel. And I think that's quite difficult for them to see, any kind of real growth, because discoverability is so difficult. It's sort of like the same discoverability on Twitch. You know, if you have 1,000 people streaming your brand new game, to try to find number 47 is very difficult, right? For streamer 47. That kind of stuff happens with patrons and Patreon accounts. So I think that supporting the creator directly definitely helps. I know it's absolutely helped me. It's helped me emotionally, you know, have a good time and discuss things with the community and we do our private servers, we do our Discord, all that stuff. Just have such a good time. But it's also helped with, you know, idea generation and discussion and helping other channels, which I think is vital, because at some point I'll die and there'll be somebody else that I hope, you know, carries on and starts doing video game reviews. And, you know, somebody who might have learned something. Especially when I started, nobody really helped anybody else. They all considered themselves competition. And I would say you still certainly get that, but it's much less now. And a lot of times you'll see people who are like, generally like, you know what? We're not really competition. It's rarely do you steal a view for a view. It's just not really like that anymore. Because people are looking for so much data and so much information. So you also have merchandise. I think merchandise is quite odd, because you can hire companies that I know of that will take care of everything. They'll make you the art and they'll create everything. You don't really do anything. Somebody else create a link even. And then the person clicks a link, buys a shirt. That shirt's made somewhere else, shipped from them to the person. If they want to return it, it's via them and all that. I don't do that right now. What I do is I design all my shirts. I get artists that I like their ideas and we discuss something for ACG but when I get their artistry, I put it on a shirt myself. We decide how it fits. We use one of the companies that allows for image adjustments, you know, getting them on a shirt, getting them printed and getting them put out there. Of course I make less in volume by a great deal, cause I've only sold a couple. I also don't push them, but it's one of those kind of things where I think you have to be pretty big to be doing merchandise, right? You can start it, you'll get a couple people, but I think overall people wear merchandise for a couple reasons. The first being to support the creator, and that's very hard if you're a very small creator. Additionally, it might be art, which is then you have to upfront money to get really good art unless you're good on your own, or a really good tagline, something really funny on your shirt, you know, that, that people think is funny and is a good tagline for whatever you're trying to do. So merchandise is an odd one. You have monetization on Twitch, and you've got Amazon Prime, which I think Amazon Prime is one of the best ways for people to get support on Twitch. You know, it's just like it, for them, they already have Prime. Subscribing to you literally costs them nothing, technically, additionally, from what they've already expected to be spending on Prime. And it really does help out a channel grow. I think that's great. And I would like to see more systems like that. But when it comes down to it, I think we're looking at another 2 or 3 years before any of this sort of solidifies out. I think you're going to see a lot of crazy stuff going on with like YouTube and the algorithms that are occurring there. Some difficulty I think we're going to be seeing there with discoverability, with how videos are even monetized. I think we're going to see some changes there. I've definitely heard some rumors about some pretty gnarly changes when it comes to all this. So it's going to be interesting, Johnny. I don't know. I'm sorry. That's something that when it comes down to it, it sort of fits back into the first question, which is, you know, how much are you worth? We're going to come to a point where there's so many people vying for so many different dollars that you really are going to find it difficult for any kind of discoverability. And then you have.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
To offer something, right? You have to offer something. I think that that only makes sense. You want to offer something so somebody wants to support your channel. And with YouTube, support was created automatically because you created a video, you uploaded it, views were the support, right? That was the support. The view was the support. The view equaled a certain amount of the ad, and then that would be given to you, what is it, every month, I think. But especially like with myself, with getting every major review demonetized at least once during the, you know, the initial release of the video, that kind of thing is dying out as well. And it can be quite difficult. And it also depends on what you're covering, right? It also depends on what YouTube is doing now, where they're like, okay, if your kid's doing an unboxing, we're going to treat that as child abuse or whatever. There's some pretty crazy stuff going on. So it's going to be a wild ride. Nutwalls. Should all games innovate? Asks Nutwalls. Should all games innovate? That's a good question. No, they don't have to, but I think, so first of all, you also have to look at time. Innovation a lot of times is driven, I think, by like a lot of technologies coming together and something being available that you can do that you couldn't do prior, or an idea that comes about that you couldn't do prior. Matrix came about, new camera techniques, that kind of stuff. Certain game elements, blinks, allowed you to record on the original Xbox because of how it did some things. You were able to play a game where time reversed and you could sort of destroy a bridge, then put the bridge back up, run across it, and then it would destroy behind you again. All kinds of crazy stuff. Those things are great, by the way, those kind of elements. But I think innovation is a poorly misused and overused word right now. You get a lot of people are like, this innovates, that innovates, this needs to innovate, that needs to innovate. I think that there's a position for everybody. We have seen a lot of games really do an amazing job just being good and polished. I think you could say in some way polish might be innovation because some games aren't polished. That certainly comes into the discussion. But innovation in and of itself is not required. I think what is required is putting together something where everything feels like it gels together very well. And that could be your innovation right there, where maybe two elements gel well. For example, remember in the past we had Castlevania and we had Metroid. Now you've got, you know, Metroidvania style games, right? You think about it like that. But even better examples would be when I was growing up, you would never have a racing game and a first person shooter element mixed together because it just wasn't possible. The technology wasn't there. And then you have games like GTA where you jump in a car and you have full missions in the cars. Then you get out and then you're shooting. You have first person, third person. And it's not a different engine. It's all in the same engine. You have, and that innovates and you have those kind of changes. So then you have innovation in the online space, how people affect your game, drive avatars and Forza. Is that innovation. I don't know, but I would have a hard time describing that it wasn't. I would have a hard time really telling you that that wasn't at least somewhat innovative. Did it always work? No, but that idea is very robust, very sound, and quite fun. For example, there were times where I was driving in Forza games and I would see my friend's, you know, username come up, and I knew they weren't online. It was their Drivatar. But they drove like the Drivatar, and that was fun because they weren't couch co-oping with me at the time. But it sort of felt like in this weird way, you were sharing the same space, right? You were sort of together at the same time, which I think is very cool. So innovation is great, but I don't necessarily think every title needs to do it. And I and some titles just by putting things together well can work out on its own. Warmonger Master says, why is HDR a mess? Why is HDR a mess is a big question. So for people who want to know what HDR is, HDR is high dynamic range. Basically, it's the adjustment of your brightness and your color into a wider spectrum than we're accustomed to seeing. Brighter TVs, that's why you start seeing, you know, the nits rating come up a lot, which is a weird name or a weird title for something, but it just means it's a unit of brightness. And HDR, of course, having a signal and being mapped towards brighter brights than we're accustomed to. So HDR is a mess right now because it really exploded. When you look at HDR and how it happened, it was big in cameras, but it wasn't really big in any kind of display for quite a while. And then it sort of exploded, became big very quickly, and a lot of game companies still haven't even figured it out. And in fact, many games still don't even actually have it in their games yet. They haven't got it all figured out to where it makes sense in their games. And then you have the adjustments, and we see this in a lot of games where, so if you look at the game as your source, you really have two sources. You have your game and your console itself. We'll just talk about consoles for a second. And then you have your TV, which is your endpoint display. You connect that HDMI cable, which for many TVs is somewhat stupid. And what I mean by that is there's some data transferred across, but not all the data that maybe you would need for HDR to perfectly display the picture. So then you have adjustments. Well, no two TV companies can even agree on the adjustments names being the same, let alone their settings being the same. Then you have different technologies. You've got your OLED and you have your LED, and then you have, you know, your edge lits, you have local dimming, you have all these kinds of different fancy things that work within those technologies as well to make your HDR TV. You have a problem there with all of those talking together, right? And until that gets fixed, and I would say that would be our next generation of consoles where we start to see some fixes there, we won't see an improvement too much. We'll see some iteration where people come up with some good ideas. My personal opinion would be, and I luckily do know some people who are working on this technology, is that we need to see more apps, right? And we need to see more things on the console, which we already see on the consoles now, but more things on the console that allow for you to test what your settings are and if they're proper for the game, that allows for that adjustment with a picture on the screen. One of the craziest things I think I've ever seen, and I'm still blown away, so many games do it, is when you get that game with the menu and it'll be like anti-aliasing, and you'll switch it and you can see the blurred image behind your menu. You can actually see the anti-aliasing switching, but the fucking everything's blurred. And you're like, couldn't you have made a small section so I could see through this menu blur, so I can see what's changing, so I know if that's the way I want the game to look? Same thing occurs with HDR. I would love to see more apps on HDR TVs that can be run that can allow you to sort of see what you need to see and adjust things. I love that the Xbox has it, and I believe the PS4 does, but I know the Xbox does. It has some ability for you to go in and some display tests that you can run and a couple settings that you can make. But it's quite convoluted still, and it will be until we get sort of a larger number of games backing it up, and then that requirement starts to come out being pushed by the consumer to sort of get all this in line. You have the new HDMI spec, you've got, you know, new levels of HDR coming out, you've got new TVs coming out as well, you've got all these things sort of coming together, and you have the new consoles as well on top of all that. I think we will see it, especially when you see a game that does HDR very well and you sort of begin to notice it. It will become an issue where it becomes a talking point, and then it sort of hits some kind of global consciousness when it comes to the actual people within that environment, which is video games, and it becomes sort of a source of change. One of the things also is it's very easy to sell 4K, right? Because you can show them usually the resolution. You can be like, boom, here's the difference on the same TV. But on an HDR TV, many times because of the different type of panels displayed on, sometimes saying, here's an HDR picture on this TV, here's HDR. It takes a while to flip over. There's some couple issues there. Some don't really show very well. And it's a little bit more difficult to display instantly that difference. A lot of games are going to need to do that to sell you. And you also can't show somebody an SDR improvement on an HDR improvement on an SDR screen. You can't be like, here's HDR. You have to actually fake it. And that faking then causes people to see real HDR and go, well, that doesn't look as good as what I saw over here. And it's like, yeah, because that was faked, because you technically don't have the display. It's sort of a chicken and egg kind of situation going on there. Windows 10 has not handled HDR very well at all either. And they've done some patches to sort of fix it up and fix up how it turns on when it does and your settings. But it also needs some changes there. So I would say time is your biggest thing. You're looking at that, as well as hopefully these companies can all decide on the same fucking name for things. And, brightness and contrast was pretty easy, right? But then you start getting all these kind of weird things with game mode and luminosity and, you know, Instacolor and all these crazy terms that are on one TV but aren't on another, and be really confusing for people. I think time is probably the biggest fixer of that. The next up, the Tiered Wizard says, what's a game license you see not living up to its full potential? That's a good question. What's a game license you see not living up to its full potential? I don't want to go with something that's not cheaty, but something that like is used all the time, which is Star Wars. So I'll say, Star Trek, actually. Star Trek. One of the reasons why is because you have like Bridge Commander, which is great, or Bridge Crew, sorry, which is great on VR, now works on pancake versions, normal screens. And I think they did a great job there. But other than Star Trek Online, there really isn't a big, and a couple mobile games, there really isn't a big Star Trek game. And I think that could be quite enjoyable, not necessarily because I'm a big fan of Discovery, but just because there are so many timelines. You also have the Picard TV show coming, which I know a lot of people are excited for. I think that is really a place where in the past, when I was younger, we did see more of those games, Legacy and a couple others. Of course, the originals, those were all great. Bridge Commander, right, was great. But we haven't seen it lately. And I would really like to see a Star Trek game, or a couple be made. I think it's still a viable fiction that just hasn't really got the support that I personally would like to see. So that's the IP for me. Last question. Johnson Inside Johnson Inside Johnson. Tech specs for PS5. What are your thoughts? Okay. Real quick, I do want to say one thing. They didn't really announce specs. Specs, base word, specification. And specifics, that's not really what we got. We got some ideas and some words, some inspiring, awe-inspiring, unique, immersive. We found out what overall chipset or within the line chipset that they were using, but we didn't get CPU speed and we didn't get GPU speed, or even if CPU and GPU are on the same die, or if Infinity Fabric will be connecting them, or what exactly is happening there. I think with those specs, there is nothing there I did not expect. Funny enough, spec. I did not get surprised when they announced those kind of things. That's pretty much where you would expect it. Push the limits as much as you can, but at the same time, you got to make it somewhat cost effective. We really saw the Jaguar CPUs having a lot of issues, and this new line is definitely going to fix that. You know, you've got your 8 and 16, which is going to be a huge jump in your core threads. You've got, obviously the optimizations that have been made, the speed, then the GPU. You have the fact that ray tracing is there, but ray tracing is already now being shown to work in software, not well, but work in software. And then, of course, you have your hardware tuned actual accelerated applications. I'm saying that it's supported or that it's possible is great. I think all of them in some way will, but I want to see how that plays out, how much of it is supported, because there's more elements than just saying, boom, ray tracing works. And anybody who studies ray tracing, you start to follow that, you start to realize that there's a reason why it does take a while even to get an older game, many times even more difficult, to get an older game to actually work for some of these demos and stuff. So that's exciting for sure. I think the sound stuff is very exciting. As somebody who loves to talk about sound, talking about it is incredibly exciting to me. Unfortunately, it's just not a seller for a lot of people. I do sound, music, and voice because I find them important. And I think that people, forget just how useful a good sound sampling, channeling, mixing, all of the different stuff, dynamic range, what that can mean, sound occlusion, all those are such a big deal. So when, you know, Mark was talking about how it's going to have a you know, advanced hardware sound chip, that's great. I think Microsoft has done a great job with the current stuff that they have, the Dolby and Sonic. It doesn't have a ton of support, but I love the fact that we're getting more support for audio. PS4 will do it. You can bet Xbox will. I think that's great. I just don't necessarily know if it's going to sell. That's more like selling somebody a Porsche when they're already on the Porsche lot, right? To me, that's great, but it won't necessarily affect a lot of folks. I had this discussion in my Discord recently, and I wasn't depressed, but I was sort of interested, I guess, in the results of a discussion we had, which was, you know, what are you listening to video games on? And the number of people using their mono one speaker, you know, TV was pretty high. And even for shooters, and they were doing fine, because of course you can, you know, if you're good, you can still do fine. You know, you're using your other sensors and stuff like that. But then you get somebody who comes and they hear a good system, and they're, you see them just go like, holy shit. But a little bit like showing HDR on an SDR display being impossible, it's really hard to say, hey, listen to this amazing audio. And they're like, okay, let's listen to it. And you're like, where's your theater system? And they're like, oh, it's just my TV. You're like, well, damn. So headphones are great. We're going to see, they did talk about the headphones being supported. You do have the caveat of a lot of people finding virtualization of 7.1, 5.1 on headsets not being the greatest. We don't know exactly what they're doing there. That'll be an improvement. I think the last thing to talk about, of course, is the storage set. Looks to be, at least from what they're saying, a mixture. I would guess a mixture of something like a quick cache, as well as a sort of a normal M2 kind of device, which has dropped in price considerably, actually. And I could see them having a main storage device being a hard drive, maybe a hybrid even, but a hard drive, and then having some kind of game storage area, which is your M2, as well as your faster cache to get these load times that they're talking about. You can say that, and to give you an example, if you have a hybrid hard drive, you can sort of see these improvements when you load up a game one time on a hybrid hard drive, and then again and again and again. And by the time you've loaded it a couple times, a lot of that game's data and the structures and the directories, that's all in that faster cache. And so you get a much faster loading screen. Here, it was blindingly fast. But I would be more interested in what happens if you switch from one game to the other. Or is it like where you basically alert the system, hey, I want you to install Spider-Man, right? Which was the example they showed. And you're playing Spider-Man, but then if you want to play EDF5, and you go to EDF5, you still have a little while those two are switched out. It's going to be very fast for sure. But remember that in these kind of situations, you're also going to be playing a game and then transferring it to the faster memory at the same time, and you're hitting some issues there. It's exciting stuff, guys. Exciting stuff. But nothing really, I wasn't as shocked, I guess, as a lot of other people were. I know some people weren't. But I think what we saw, if you look at the improvements in technology and you look at the way game engines are going and the expected power that a game engine might require for a next gen, and as well as backwards compatibility, which I think we all assumed was going to happen, PS4 would not, and PS5 and Sony would not allow that to continue without backwards compatibility. I think these are all expected changes overall. I'd love to see them improve the PS4 or PS5 battery controller. Battery and its length of time. I definitely have been at times very negative towards how long those last. I don't know why. I know some people are like, man, mine lasts for 24 days or whatever. Mine certainly do not. I would like to see some improvements there. PSVR is also said to be forward compatible. I think that's great, but because you can't technically improve the display technology in the PSVR, I really do assume they will have a PSVR Pro of some kind, and that will be your 1440p resolution or something like that, double screen, where, you know, at least at WMR levels, which would be very cool. So it's exciting stuff. It's very exciting. We won't know exactly where they are until they, you know, tape off the chips and get them in the fab and start making them. And just like the Xbox One got a boost for its CPU, I believe, right before its release, We won't know the exact speeds pretty much until we're very close to release. We'll know the basic one, like, okay, here's what we're shooting for. And then, you know, maybe they'll get some improvement out of it right at the end. Who knows? It's going to be fun to see what they can do. Sony, I think, does a great job with their hardware tech. I also would love for them to fix their cooling system, because I think the PS4 Pro in particular sounds like a vacuum cleaner. I can hear it right now, and it is quite literally halfway across the room, and I can hear it because I have a game on pause. Yeah, right now I can hear it. So that would be great to see that fixed. But other than that, not too surprised. It'd be great to see what Microsoft says, but I think they'll be pretty much in line. I don't think there's going to be anybody who's looking at a system going, oh shit. I think overall, as other people have said, and the rumors I have heard and some people I've talked to, both of them are shooting for about the same thing. So anyway, that's it for me. I thank everybody for the discussion. These are always unique questions and I love answering them. It's always cool to be able to sit down and do a little gabbing with you guys, take some questions on Twitter, take some questions on Facebook, and just see what people are thinking about at this time, what they're enjoying, what games they want to talk about, what they think of tech. If you agree or disagree, feel free to put it in the comments what you think, you know, questions that you may have. I try to check the comments as often as possible. Other than that, I want to say peace out. Enjoy the rest of your week and look forward for, I have three reviews. So look forward to three reviews coming from me very soon. If you get a chance, check out the Patreon.